Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal, the special worldwide radio broadcast. Today is Sunday, June 20th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of our program. Later on, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the announcement by the Ethiopian government that land has been prepared for agricultural production in the rest of Tigray region in the north. A recently released article says that the African continent has not reached a 10% investment level in agriculture. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has again spoken out on the need to democratize multilateral organizations. And the Angolan state is battling an upsurge in malaria infections. In the second and third hours, we continue our focus on Black Music Month. We'll have examinations of the contributions of Willie McTell as well as Rosetta Tharpe. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Right now, we'll take a musical interlude again to the Democratic Republic of Congo. We have a selection of music from the early 1970s, from the Orchestra of Veve, from the Bakuba Band, the Zaiko Langa Langa, the Orchestra Bella Bella, and the Orchestra Lapue Lapue. Let's listen in.
Oh mama, oh mama, keep on Solange mama, kolinga yo masamba Mwana mama Nati yo motema Lelo na kopanda Olingwe loko ya kopi mela moto te Solo mama okatinga y motema Motema langa y moto ni solo na tua Nako kiko mi boma hoho Nasara kikutu kolanda yoho Kanisa nanu nanzela ya kelansi masamba Pula na moi nandote mama
Nampiri bakubai
Zima kitena koka kikolinda yo masama Mwana mama, nati yo motema Lelo na kopanda Olingwe loko ya kosi mela moto te Solo mama okatinga e motema Motema langa e moto ni solo na zua Na koki komi boma hoho Kansara kikutu kolanda yoho Kanisa nanu nanzela ya kelasi masaba Pula na moi nandote mama
Kufile, bacha kitembe
Mosika na tobanza yoho masamba e Kula na moina zote mama Na komi kokona ye masamba e Kula na moina zote mama Uluwe tina mweleze ye masamba o Yela keko tina motema e mama Jua na mfula kukwili ye masamba o Yela keko tina motema e mama Mosika na tobanza yo e masamba e Kula na moina zote mama Na komi kokone kokondo masamba Kula na moina zote mama
Kondo 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 pola makanitie
Kula na moi nandote mama Jua na mfula kumili ne masamba o
Elange koti na mose mbae mama
Tuluwe sino mweleze ye masamba o
Elange koti na mose mbae mama Kama leo yo yo yo. Kama leo yo yo yo. Kama leo yo kisinga isoni. Nami sone ya bamba na nanga na yeti nyonzo. Na zange ya tali loba. Pone loba o bamba na ko bamba na. Mwe mamba mwone linga.
Kama la male.
Kama la male. Oh mama. Kama la male.
Na pesi o loboko.
Kama la male. Oh mama. Kama la male.
Kota linga yi bamba.
Kama la male. Kama la male,
oyo kisinga isoni.
Kama la male, oh mama. Kama la male.
Komengo wana mokili,
solanga na malembe, kolinga matope na mokili,
zala na mayele,
na sali nyako poso zala o,
kamalele,
na pendi ya longonya, kasi longona kalo bako, na lita maoko papa,
na pendi ya longonya,
kasi longona kalo bako, na lita maoko papa,
usiwe sali o diye,
kasi longona maoko papa.
Oh kamale, kamale.
Kamala male. Oh mama. Kamala male.
Kamale wana mama.
Kamala male. Oh mama. Kamala male.
Kamale. Naboti no bana mama.
Kamala male,
yeah.
Kamala male, oh mama.
Welcome back, and this is the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. We just heard some of the classic Pan-African Congolese orchestras from the early 1970s, music recorded during that time period. It was a compilation of songs from the Orchestra Vive from Bakuba, Zaiko Langalanga, the Orchestra Bella Bella, and the Orchestra Lapue Lapue. And this is Black Music Month, and of course we are, as always, listening to a wide variety and diversity of music produced and recorded by African people. And of course, right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And our lead story, and these are some of the headlines that are in the Pan-African Newswire for today, Sunday, June 20th, 2021. The lead story is on Ethiopia. An article from the Ethiopian Herald says about 70% of agricultural land in Ethiopia's Tigray state has been made ready for Kerimet or Mahera, meaning summer cropping season, according to the Ministry of Agriculture. The ministry made the announcement yesterday while briefing journalists on land preparation for farming in the state. At the event, Ministry of Agriculture State Minister Sani Reddy indicated that the ministry, in collaboration with the Tigray Agricultural and Natural Resources Office, cooperative unions, and local and international partners, are now working on restoring and strengthening organizational structure of the agricultural sector. The ministry has also restarted basic extension services and eco supply services for the year 2021 cropping season, he further indicated. Accordingly, the ministry has purchased office equipment and vehicles worth 10 million birr, the national currency of Ethiopia, and conducted awareness creation and motivational training for its staffers in the state. Moreover, agricultural inputs, supplies, and trainings have been undergoing with AgroCalendar in collaboration with all stakeholders. Hence, out of 61 rural Waritas, 56 of them have enabled to engage in routine farming activities. Currently, the State Office of Agriculture and Natural Resources are mobilizing resources for the restoration of agricultural sector to zonal, Warito, Cabele levels in the state, the state minister said. In other news, on the African continent as a whole, in 2003, the heads of state and government of the African Union recognized that greater public spending on agriculture was needed to eradicate hunger and poverty across the continent. This prompted them to make a political commitment, the Maputo Declaration, to allocate at least 10% of their national budget to food and agriculture under the Comprehensive Africa Agricultural Development Program. Almost 20 years later, many countries, including 13 studies in a new research, have not yet reached the objective pledged in Maputo. Despite sub-Saharan African registering currently recording lower COVID-19 infections and deaths than other regions in the world, the latest economic projections from the International Monetary Fund say it could experience a contraction in regional economies by about 3%, with an average of gross domestic product per capita drop of up to 5.4% back to levels of the beginning of the decade. Now, even before the COVID-19 pandemic, hunger in sub-Saharan Africa was slowly rising, according to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. In 2019, an estimated 690 million people suffered from undernourishment, 235 million of whom were in sub-Saharan Africa. In the region, agricultural remains the source of employment and a critical sector in terms of economic development. The continent is facing an unprecedented economic crisis that could push an additional 5 million to 29 million people into poverty. They could end up losing 19 million jobs, and also the number of undernourished people in food-importing countries could increase by 14.4 million to 80.3 million people as a whole. Expenditure on food and agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa, trends, challenges, and priorities found few countries have met the 10% Maputo target, despite a renewed commitment to, in 2014 through the Malabo Declaration. Surprisingly, research showed that an average 21% of budgets devoted to food and agriculture in the regions were not spent, often due to either funds being dispersed too slowly or complications in project implementation. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswatch segment of the Pan-African Journal. In the East African state of Kenya, the president of that country, Uhuru Kenyatta, has made a statement in relationship to the lack of democratization within multilateral organizations. And President Uhuru Kenyatta has called for the democratization of multilateral organizations so as to ensure inclusivity in decision-making. The president, who spoke on Friday at an interactive session on governance at the ongoing Italia Diplomacy Forum in Turkey, said changing how multilateral institutions such as the United Nations are managed will help in quicker resolution of global challenges such as COVID-19. The president said that it will really depend on us being able to change the global governance system, the manner in which the United Nations Security Council works, the manner in which the UN and its organizations work, in order for us to determine as to whether we shall see change, according to President Uhuru Kenyatta. And finally, in the Republic of Angola in Southern Africa, the Minister of Health, Sylvia Lutukuta, said on Thursday in the capital of Luanda that Angola is facing a serious and challenging situation related to malaria. The minister said that more than 2 million patients are affected in the last 5 months. Speaking at a press conference on the current situation of the disease, the minister put it at 5,573, the total number of deaths from malaria in recent months. The minister added that in 5 months, the health authorities reported a death rate of about 0.1% among the cases assisted in different health facilities of the country. She said despite the increase in the cases of malaria, the country reported a decrease in the number of deaths compared to the figure recorded in 2020, but she would not specify the comparative data. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. We want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. Now, this press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since that time, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that is at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. Not only can you have access to today's program for Sunday, June 20th, 2021, but well over 1,000 other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal. The programs can be shared with other potential listeners via email, through blogs and websites, and the links can be shared through social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. And we'll take a break with Howling Wolf, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. This worldwide radio broadcast, special edition of our program for Sunday, June 20th, 2021, and that was the music of Mr. Chester Arthur Burnett, popularly known as Howlin' Wolf, and from Sunflower County, Mississippi. And, of course, we play Howlin' Wolf here all during the year. And all the great black artists who have graced this planet. Right now we want to move into Black Music Month commemorations. Today we're going to look at a Georgia blues artist known as Blind Willie McTell. And this audio documentary gives an insight into the development of rural and indigenous African-American music from the South, its evolution, its connection with African-American culture and African-American historical periodization. And of course, all during the period of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, African-Americans were struggling for their release from national oppression, economic exploitation, and racism. And
I'm born
course,
in Thompson, Georgia, down about 134 miles
into the 21st century. Let's
born
listen.
About 9 miles ahead from this little town, between the two creeks, they call it, Little Bry and Big Bry.
A few miles outside Thompson, deep in the farming country of Middle Georgia, the year is 1901, the month of May. He's born blind, and because he will come to know his name by ear, and in the distinct local accent, McTeer will become McTell, so that one day, Willie Samuel McTeer will call himself McTell, Blind Willie McTell. He was an outside child, born out of wedlock to Minnie Watkins, all of 14, and Eddie McTeer, a gambler and moonshiner. A few months after the baby was born, Eddie was gone. Minnie moved a few miles south to the tiny hamlet of Stapleton, keeping the McTeer name for her baby and herself. Country life had drifted along in slow motion through the last decades of the 19th century, but it was motion all the same.
Because freedom was now a reality and not a future possibility, many slaves, ex-slaves, left plantations looking for what they thought was their piece of land. Many of them also were looking very, very hard for members of families that had been taken away during that particular period. So there was a great deal of movement throughout the South as people began to seek that particular spot that they wanted to settle upon or to find family and bring them back together again. After the turn of the century, we're past post-Reconstruction, there's a re-intensification of racial oppression in the South in particular. And I say in the South in particular because it was also occurring in the North. And what we begin to find is that the desire for better jobs, more economic opportunity, and a less oppressive social environment was probably the combination that inspired many African Americans to get on the road, to go somewhere else. In that process, you had people for the first time being alone for long periods of time as opposed to having been thrust together as a working body. And so the field holler and call became much more prominent. And an example I can think of is the Wild Ox Moan in terms of the lone singer bouncing off him or herself. Why don't you come here, black woman? Sit down on daddy's knee. Mm-hmm. Why don't you come here, black woman? Sit down on daddy's knee. Mm-hmm. And so after a while, you just add your own words, but that mm-hmm is what eventually evolves into what the guitar does. Okay, so when you have an instrumentation, the answer comes from the instrument, not from the voice generally, okay? And so we see that evolution of the singing and the instrumentation becoming one seamless musical activity.
Change was coming. Those who had known slavery firsthand were dying off, and memories of that world were fading into shadow. The post-war years had produced minstrel troupes that featured banjo-plucking, razor-toting darkies as their stars. They created a body of music, coon songs, that offered up the same crude stereotypes. For much of America, this was the sum of black music as the turn of the century approached. But the black troops turned away from the caricatures, leaving only white imitators, and the banjo, the popular instrument of African origin, fell into disrepute. But there were echoes just over the horizon. Scott Joplin turned Placid Parlor piano into the bubbling energy of ragtime. And in New Orleans, Buddy Bolden was blowing the first hot notes of the music they called jazz. And along the Mississippi Delta and in East Texas and at country crossroads in Georgia and the Carolinas, a new music was ready to make its entrance. But first, the stage had to be set. After the economic panic in 1893, J.P. Morgan monopolized Southern railroads and soon had the South entwined in a web of steel rail. At the same time, the U.S. Postal Service was expanding the new rural free delivery and parcel post systems from 38 RFD routes 4 years before Willie McTell's birth to 38,000 of them by the time he was six. This in turn made it possible for Sears Roebuck to dominate the new mail order industry. By 1900, the Sears catalog was a fixture in every rural home. Their country folk found pages filled with guitars, the popular instruments that had made their way north from Mexico and across the ocean from Southern Europe and into 19th century American parlors. They were cheap and seemed easy to play. When a minor guitar craze faded, the instruments found their way into black hands. It was the guitar that gave backing to the music that was rising from the farm fields and along the dirt roads and in small towns across the South.
To play the guitar in the old days, to do old-fashioned picking, and they used to call it old-fashioned picking, you would have to play the guitar just like it was a piano. One hand is our thumb. And this would be the left hand of the piano player. The left hand is usually going like this on a piano, going boom, chick, boom, chick. And in English, it's interesting because it's not going boom, boom. It's usually playing one note and then a chord. So the actual sound is a boom and a heavier sound, chick, which actually leads into it being dance music, boom, chick. So with our thumb, we go alternate the bass on the guitar. And we're going to play, for instance, here the sixth and the fourth string. And instead of just going boom, boom, I actually get a heavier backbeat going. So that's one hand. Obviously, the second hand is the hand that's playing the chords. And then the third hand is just the little old index finger is playing melody lines, what the right hand usually plays on the piano. So whereas a piano player is going like this, and with his hand tinkling away, you have the guitar playing this piano-based music. And then from there, in this old-fashioned picking, it sort of developed as dance styles changed.
I grew up there till I was 9 years old. My mother left there and went down to Bullock County.
It was this music, this blues, that nine-year-old Willie McTell heard when his mother moved them to Statesboro, a small city to the south. It was this blues that he heard on the streets, at the Saturday markets and country fairs, and when the medicine shows came to town. And on Sunday, he still heard the deep gospel of a Baptist church. It was in Statesboro that he first picked up a six-string guitar. From then on, he was never without it.
Stay there till I run away. And I run away and went everywhere, everywhere I could go without any money. I followed shows all around till I began to get grown.
He wanted to play music, so he ran off with the medicine show, known as Erstwhile Training Academies for Young Players. He spent his teenage years on the byways of the Southeast. Music was surging forward.
About 1910, 1915, you would have this type of music. If you watch that thumb, just doing that alternating bass, and this is very reminiscent of the way John Hurt would play. about the 20s, a man called Blind Blake comes along and makes some incredibly popular records for Paramount Race Records. And he's, instead of going boom, chick, the Charleston was really popular. So he starts to, what Reverend Davis said, he had a sporting right hand. And he would sort of jump that bass. Really try and exaggerate for you now so you can hear that. Town on. He was a very influential guitar player, especially to the blues people, the guitar players from the Atlanta area, from the Carolina area, the Georgia area. That whole Piedmont area, Blind Blake was the real governor, the Eric Clapton, if you will, of that style of guitar playing.
While he was away, his mother married and had a son, Willie's half-brother. He came back to Statesboro and to Thompson, as he would throughout his life. But he would not truly come home for a long time.
My mother, she died and left in 1920. And after then I got on my own. I could go anywhere I wanted then without letting anybody know where I was. I didn't have nobody to write back to. But a brother, 3 years old, and he wasn't able to understand.
After Minnie was gone, Willie drifted. For a short while, he put down his guitar to make moonshine in South Georgia. In the early 20s, a Statesboro neighbor paid his way to the blind school in Macon. From there, he went on to blind schools in Michigan and New York. When he came back to Georgia in 1924, he was swept up in a wave of emotion that was general across the South. Farm work had supported most of the black population, and black farm ownership had grown steadily until 1920, when the boll weevil all but destroyed the South's single crop farming. Black families had to leave the land. Most would never return.
Many people think, well, they left the South and went to the North. But actually, many of them left the South and went to the South. In other words, they left the small country areas or rural areas where they were working on farm and moved to towns and cities in the South. And so you find people moving from the Mississippi Delta area into areas like Memphis and Chattanooga, Tennessee. You find people moving from the rural areas of Georgia into Atlanta.
Willie McTell followed his audience into a city he had visited in his travels, a city where he heard there was a market for the blues. Thompson had been his birthplace, Statesboro his hometown, but Atlanta would be his stage.
Out in Atlanta on Harris Street, that's where the boys and gals do meet, doing that rag, that Georgia rag. Out in the alley, in the street, every little kid that you meet, doing that rag, that old Georgia rag. Spank that Georgia rag, boy.
The city was a magnet, then as now, the hub of the Southeast, the richest metropolis in the region. When the land fell, black families migrated there in droves, carried forward by optimism or driven by desperation. The flood of humanity doubled the city's population in a single decade. For blacks in the Southeast, Atlanta was a Mecca. At least, that was the image. In reality, the city was neither a haven of opportunity nor a sanctuary from racism. The flood of migrants from the country frightened whites, and the Ku Klux Klan, feeding on these fears, became active in politics. Klan influence reached into the mayor's office, the governor's mansion, and the state senate. The city affected a blueprint for segregation. Blacks were forced into neighborhoods like the one that ran from Decatur Street to Auburn Avenue, and from Peachtree Street to Boulevard. In the 1920s, these 10 square blocks featured the poorest housing, the highest number of relief cases, and the worst crime rate in the city. But it was also the stomping ground of the Atlanta blues musicians, especially Decatur Street, a busy boulevard crammed with stores and theaters and barbershops and other more marginal enterprises. It was there that the black community came for entertainment, to a moving stage where songsters plied their trade day and night, inside and out. Atlanta street music became a small industry with the appearance of the record companies. Edison's phonographs were now within everyone's means, and the companies were hungry for talent to fill up their fat 78 RPM race records. Atlanta became a recording center for both blues and country musicians. In quick succession, players like Peg Leg Howell, Eddie Anthony, Bob and Charlie Hicks, and Fred McMullen turned that blues size for RCA Victor, Paramount, and a dozen other labels. Willie McTell spent his first year there playing the streets and house parties and the occasional afternoon show reserved for blacks at the 81 Theater. And Sunday mornings find him singing at Mount Zion Baptist Church. In 1927, McTell made his first recording for the Victor label. He would record at least once a year for the next 9 years. He cut records for Victor and OK and Columbia. He used monikers like Blind Sammy and Hotshot Willie and Georgia Bill to dance around contracts. Everyone did it. Over the next 7 years, he would lay down over 80 sides for 8 different labels. Among those sides were his classics.
Turn your lamp down low. Have you got the nerve to drive Papa Martell from your door?
He was a singular talent, and no one echoed and reflected Atlanta's patchwork energy like Willie McTell. He was based in the ragtimey Piedmont style, and he borrowed from Lemon Jefferson's field holler voice and guitar, from rag masters like Blind Blake and Blind Boy Fuller, from the Delta progenitors like Charlie Patton, and from the impassioned spirituality of Blind Willie Johnson. He borrowed from all, but copied none, in forging a style completely his own. He made his music even more unique with the 12-string guitar that he picked up and turned into his trademark.
Now that's not note for note what Blind Willie McTell was playing, but it gives you an idea. It's sort of that alternating bass is very ragtimey, and using a 12-string, he can get away with just strumming the guitar. It's a very dynamic sound. Again, I'm not going to play this note for note the way McTell did it, but you have things like in the key of C. Simple accompaniments. Again, the 12-string allows him to be simple because it's such a massively sounding instrument. It has so much sound involved. But he has a lot of tunes that he does pick a lot on. His famous tune, Statesboro Blues, we go down to what I call a drop D tune. We're talking amazing sound. And he has a lick. Tune, at one point he goes, and he's talking about tell his mother, tell his brother, tell his sister. That's playing the piano. That's just playing octaves. As a piano player would do that in his left hand, playing octaves on the guitar. Like this, you couldn't get away with on a 6-string. It'd sound too empty. It would sound too nude. Whereas on 12, it has a lot of body. Then he had the bottleneck tunes like Mama Tain Long for Day and Three Women Blues. He also had one other tune called Broke Down Engine. Now this is sort of interesting to my way of thinking because with most of McTell's tunes, especially the early ones, you have a feeling that he was a musician who wrote his own music. And most bluesmen, you don't get that feeling. You get the feeling that they're playing a tune that's a dance tune, And they're just putting together a collective consciousness of verses, and out comes a blues. Or they may be singing about an event, the high water everywhere. They're talking about the floods in Mississippi. McTell did that. He spoke about topical events, so he was, in a way, like a Bob Dylan of his day, talking about what was happening. Those were original tunes. He would sing folk songs like the Delias, but very rarely was he singing songs, cover versions, that other blues musicians were doing. Very rarely. Yet, he comes from Atlanta, Georgia, which had a wonderful scene of blues players, Barbecue Bob, Charlie Lincoln, George Carter, who no one knows really who he is, Buddy Morse, and Curly Weaver as well. And you don't find the tunes of those musicians in the repertoire of McTell, except for Broke Down Engine. He's playing single string line. Then after that, with McTell's playing as it goes on in his later part of his recording career, he tends to stay away from picking lonesome-sounding music and getting more into the ragtime. That same dance type of material.
McTell was busy playing, recording, and traveling. He was working his way to the top of the rough-and-tumble blues world. But just as he moved within reach of the brass ring, dark clouds arose. Wall Street came crashing down, and the tremors rippled outward, even to the fledgling record industry. Within a few years, Atlanta's recording business would drift off to Memphis and Nashville and New Orleans, and most of the local bluesmen would hang up their guitars. Like McTell, they saw their chances for fame and fortune crumble under the heavy hand of the Depression. But songster to the core, he simply went back to work. He continued to perfect his voice and guitar, but there were always able musicians around. What truly set him apart was the way he used the minstrel's craft to weave his own songs.
The stories that came up, the poetry.
Sometimes it's not necessarily the music per se, but what's being played, how it's being played, what are the political ramifications of this, what is the content of the song itself, you know, what are the circumstances in which this song came to light under, you know, anybody can be a dilettante lifting up the pots in the kitchen on the stove and say, oh, I have a little bit of this, I have a little bit of that, oh, I'll smell some of this, I'll check out, well, I don't like them chillers today. You know, I mean, you can do all that kind of stuff, but there's another thing to, you know, to see what the total value of these things are. And tell, you know, brought to mind through what he was saying about what it was like to be here at that time, you know, moving around Atlanta, Statesboro, Winsboro, wherever he was moving, you know. Because it's obvious he rambled around here and there, you know. I mean, it's like, it still kills me. You know, Big 80 left Savannah, would not stop. You ought to see that colored fireman when he got the boilers hot talking about, reach over in the corner, mama, honey, bring me my traveling shoes. I mean, I had to sit down and say, wow, this cat is like, and all that work, when you think about it, the way he laid it out, nobody else sings it like that, no matter, I mean, he seems to me, what's interesting, this is my personal opinion. My personal opinion is that better than all men singing the blues is women singing the blues. Women can sing the blues much better than a man can. I'm sorry. I know a lot of cats just don't want to hear that. Because, see, what they did is they transferred it to being a guitar cutting contest as opposed to a singing contest. On singing and emotion alone, a woman can sing the blues. A woman can sing the blues with, without piano, guitar, whatever you want. You know, and McTell's vocal style was much more closer than the way women sing the blues, with a lot of little notes in between that your ear passes up the first time around listening to them. But after you listen to them, then 10, 15, 20 years later, going back and listening again, you realize that you only got the outside of the song. You didn't hear the inside. And that was another thing that was interesting. And also, too, he had a very high, kind of a sharp, crisp voice. You know, most everybody associate the blues band song way down here. You know what I mean? And McTell was way up here, you know? And as a matter of fact, there's one time when
he's the first line he sings something. He says something about if you don't do something, Mama, I won't trouble you no more. And he puts the R correctly in there, and then he realizes in the middle of them, they gon' I don't know who's listening to this, but the next line he comes out and says no more. He's funny. He's a funny guy. He knew how to move around, get out of people's way if they're gonna get in trouble, or he had some thought about it. He's an interesting man.
Over the next few years, he traveled far and wide, always the rambler. Though he would for the rest of his life consider Atlanta his home base, he ranged from the Mississippi to Miami. For all his travels, McTell had never recorded outside the makeshift Atlanta studios. Then, in September of 1933, he, Buddy Moss, and Curly Weaver went to New York to cut some sides for Vocalion. A few months after returning to Atlanta, McTell met Ruth Kate Williams. She was from Renz, just a few miles from Thompson. In fact, their mothers had been friends, and Willie had jokingly asked for Kate's hand in 1918 when she was only 4 and he was 17. They met now, some 15 years later, when Willie played at Payne College in Augusta, where Kate was attending high school.
I think I was maybe 10 years old. This was about 1933. My sister brought him home to our surprise as her boyfriend, soon to be her husband. My father was a rural Baptist preacher and one of the conservative kind, I suppose. And when she brought him home and introduced him as a man who played and sang the blues, he had to bring himself around to accepting him, and it was quite an exciting experience. Naturally, we were, as children, we were very excited to know that a man of his ability was coming in the family. And my father had to convince himself, if I could put it this way, that all of us would not be going to hell in case he was around. And of course, it didn't take long to convince my father. He played both spirituals, gospels, along with the blues. And of course, he eventually was not only accepted, but was greatly loved by the whole family.
They settled in Atlanta, and Kate went back for a high school diploma. She sang with him, and they traveled together during the summers. Early in 1935, the McTells, Weaver, and singer Georgia White went to Chicago to record for Decca. None of the 14 sides Willie cut were released. A recording he made later that year in Augusta with Piano Red met the same fate. McTell would not step into a studio again for 14 years. Back in Atlanta, Willie and Kate lived modestly in apartments near downtown.
This was in 1935, to be exact. I can remember I just had my 12th birthday. She was here. My sister Kate was in Grady Nursery School, and he seemed to have had some connections with whatever company it was, the Making Records in Chicago. He wanted very much for me to come and spend the summer with them. And, of course, he took pride. Well, she would go to school in the mornings. He would take me about the city to show me the landmarks and the places of history. And I was always amazed to wonder if we would truly get lost. He would tell me which car to catch, and being able to read, I could tell him what streetcar was passing, and I could read the streets. But never, never did we seem to be lost anywhere. He took me to the state capitol, which was a memorable place. He took me to the city hall. He took me to the post office. These were both old and new. These were memorable places. He took me to the Black University system, and he named the schools as we went through, Marsh Brown, Morehouse Clark. But the thing that would strike me, that were friends he had that would be living in various streets in alleys. Atlanta had a lot of alleys at that time, and he could almost go there without directions. I was always lost, but he was never lost. Every day, when she went to school, he would find somewhere to take me, to show me that was of interest. And of course, naturally, he insisted, and my father permitted me to stay with him for a whole year, which was an enjoyable year of my living.
When he wasn't out on the road, Willie spent his nights working the Atlanta streets that he now knew by heart.
Oh, yes, he would, many instances, he would let me walk him from 381 Houston Street, that's where we lived. We'd go down 4th Street, which led into Ponce de Leon, and he knew I would not get lost because I only had to change streets one time. And I would walk with him. There was a little stand right on the outside of the building at the parking lot. And he would sat on this little stand. They had a chair and a stand, and I would sit there by him. And people would come and drop nickels, dimes, and sometimes quarters in his guitar. And he would sit there and play until 10, maybe 12 o'clock at night. He would never let me wait with him, however. He would always come home alone, of which I was often concerned. Well, at the time, I was unable to make this keen distinction. How he could play, well, let me call it his blues, all of the week, even Saturday night. And on a Sunday morning, he was quite ready to go to church. And he had a keen sense of putting together his own spirituals. They came out of experiences. Now then, I know that they were more or less testimonies to some experience of desire. And listening to those songs that he did sing and play, I like to remember one, "When I'm gone, 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 when I'm gone to come no more, I know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone." This was always a desired song in our religious service. One of the things that always struck me about him, as you can see, he wore a very unique mustache. He shaped that mustache himself. He never allowed a barber to do that. And believe it or not, he did it with a straight razor. The other thing was, in spite of the fact that he was blind, I don't recall ever seeing him with shades on. He was not ashamed of his blindness. Very smooth skinned and very soft hair. Very, very smooth. The Indian type that was medium brown, always neat. He never allowed himself to believe that he was dressed until he put on his necktie. He taught me how to tie a necktie, believe it or not. He was very neat in that. He never allowed himself to be laxed in his appearance. He was very, very cautious of that. Medium-sized man, not a big man. And he dressed himself always. He might ask the color one time, and there was something about the touch of his suit. He would know the color the next time. I lived with him, and I've seen him hang his brown, his black, his blue in the closet. And when he went to the closet, if he put them in there, he would always come out with the one that he wanted. And if it was not, he had a keen sense of telling you, "This is not my brown. This is not my black. Where is it?" Very unique.
Work and wanderlust put him on the road in the late 1930s. He traveled as far as Florida and the Georgia Sea Islands. But it was to Statesboro that Willie went most often when he was away from Atlanta. Especially during tobacco season. In those long hot months, tobacco men from all over the South would gather to buy and sell. Willie played for them at the warehouses and at hotels like the Jaco, where they gathered in the evenings.
He mostly come in the back of season because he knew they all would like to hear him. And they would always meet here to hear him. All of them that wasn't in the hotel here that knew him, they would come around. He would come to the porch, and wouldn't nobody be saying anything because they'd be watching him to see, was he going to come in to the same place or was he going to pass by? And when he... And then he come home and they all go to laughing and say, "Oh boy, you know we were here and you always come to the same place." And they all, "How you doing?" And he would laugh and he said, they said, "How you been getting along?" He said, "Fine, I've been getting along fine. Where you been?" "Well, I've been up in Atlanta and around." If he knew you, if he heard your voice once or twice and called your name, he could call you a good name. Because he hadn't seen, the first time he saw me, I had never seen him. And the second time he saw me, I said, "What's my name?" He said, "You say it again." what's my name? He said, this is Johnson. I said, yeah, this is Johnson. And he said, you live with Judy Howard? I said, yeah. He said, I know you. I know you. Right out there, right on there. He'd be sitting there on the thing, and all of the tobacco men would be around me. He would stay out there about sometime an hour and a half, something like that. Yeah. And they'd all, I can see the big old rocking chairs all pull up. They'd pull them all from the other side over here to this side to hear him play the guitar. Sometimes he would sit there, and then again he would sit here. Most times the bellhops would be standing there on each side, and he would sit here. And we would come on the side and listen, and we'd go back. Sometimes it'd be late in the evening, and we would be coming in, and we would pass out there and stand and listen a little while. And that's the only time we see the mix. Either they would take a hat and sit it down there by, and every time they'd play a song, they'd put some money in there for me. And then they would, before he leave, they would count and tell him how much he had. But he could count his money. But how he could tell a $1 bill from a $10 bill or $5 bill, I don't know. But he could do it. Everybody knew it. Mostly. And then a lot of times the new men come with the tobacco men and they say, I want you to hear. And they would come and some of them stayed at other hotels and they would come and sit here and listen to them. Yeah. So I think they all enjoyed it. That was really the tobacco season then. Yeah. It was a great difference in it then than it is now. You don't know we have a battle season anymore. So I guess it won't be long before we won't have.
1940 found MacTell in Atlanta, playing the streets, which is where folklorist John Lomax found him. Lomax, seeking out talent for the Library of Congress, brought MacTell to his downtown hotel, where he cut an album worth of blues, ballads, and spirituals. In 1941, Kate received her nursing certificate from Grady Hospital. There were no jobs in Atlanta, so she traveled to New York to visit one of her sisters. She was there on December 7th. She went back to Georgia and got a job at Camp Gordon near Augusta. Willie remained in Atlanta. They stayed apart from then on, except for the times he would visit when he passed through Augusta. The wartime economy brought a flood of money to the South. For a seasoned performer, it should have meant working again as clubs reopened for business. But there was new music in the air. An interest in a solitary singer recounting tales from a murky past was scant. The clubs really hired him, and rationing kept recording slow. So he went back to the streets and out on the road.
I think one of the things that he represented was what happened to a lot of musicians at that particular time. You know, they had a few years of enjoying recording and developing their audience, and then a national and international situation came along that because they were ultimately at the bottom of the pile, you know, they were first fired from the labels, and that meant an awful lot to, you know, that helped them create the lifestyle that they had built up until the point that, you know, these different events, war, et cetera, you know, the lack of shellac, so forth and so on. And then later on, when the music came, you know, resurfaced again, it resurfaced under different auspices. So, you know, I mean, and there's a lot of people that this happened to. I mean, it went on, it can go on and on and on and on, the amount of people that the same thing happened to. But it's you know, luckily and fortunate for us, we, you know, somebody had the consciousness to record this guy and stay in tune and recording him. It's just unfortunate that his life had to follow the kind of things that it had to because of it.
Willie took up with Helen Edwards from nearby Covington. She began calling herself MacTell, though they never married. The war years passed, and McTell was pushed even further from the spotlight as the troops returned with a taste for brash, big band, and sentimental pop music. But there were also some new record labels on the scene, small companies pursuing blues, gospel, and R&B artists. They looked south.
My brother and I used to go door to door in the ghetto areas of Washington and just knock on the door and say, do you have any records you want to sell? Among the records that we found mostly in the homes of black people on whose doors we knocked and asked for to see if they would sell any old records. Among these records and the various other sources we had, we found a lot of records by Blind Lemon Jefferson, who was a very popular artist in his time. And I guess he was a great inspiration for many other blues artists. But Blind Lemon was obviously sold hundreds of thousands of records because we found a lot of those. Much rarer were the blind Willie Johnson. I'm speaking now about the blind gospel and blues singers. Blind Blake was another one. Blind Willie Johnson was much rarer. But I came across several recordings by Blind Willie McTell, who had a peculiarly sweet voice compared to the others. And I was very, very taken by him, so that I had a memory of his sound. And many years later, after we started Atlantic Records, and we were making, you know, honking tenor saxophone records and whatever we thought we could sell in the rhythm and blues market. The first trip that Herb Abramson and I took to visit our distributors and to look for talent in the South, and we especially went to the South to find the kind of blues players or musicians who were more in the blues idiom than the New York musicians and the New York singers who were much more sophisticated and had already moved away from the blues. So it was our first trip, and we were meeting our distributors. We're stopping in virtually every state, we drove down south and across to Texas. But on the way, when we stopped in Atlanta, one day we were walking in the black section of Atlanta, and which was then, of course, heavily segregated. And there was a beggar on the street corner, and I stopped to listen to him sing. He had a 12-string guitar, and I thought, my God, I wonder who this is. He was a blind man, and we gave him some money. He thanked us because there weren't a lot of people putting money in his cup. And I said, have you ever heard of Blind Willie McTell? So he said, I am Blind Willie McTell. And I couldn't believe it. And of course, then he said, how are the people at our... I said, I'm from a record company. He said, oh, really? He said, how's everybody at RCA Victor? I said, now it's a different record company. It's a new, small record company. And he didn't think that there was any other record company. And I said that we'd like to record him. And we stayed with him, you know, and we went back to our distributors, who located a small studio for us. And we went up to that studio, we booked some time, and that's when we made what was to become historic recordings.
In 1970, the company would re-release the session. It was the last studio recording for Blind Willie McTell. He was turning more and more to gospel music, singing spirituals over local radio stations. He did a stint as a guest preacher at Mount Zion Baptist Church. This religious bent did not keep him from drinking, Over the next 5 years, his health began to fail, keeping him off the road. He now played drive-in parking lots, selling songs that once turned the blues world upside down for dimes and quarters. He became a shadow on the night streets of Atlanta, and his world began to unwind. But he would have one last word.
Well, I had a friend who was an artist, and he came by after work one day and showed me his new Thunderbird. We got to talking, and he said, you know, you've expressed an interest in indigenous American music, and he said, I think I found something that you'll be interested in. So he took me for a ride in his new car, and we went down Ponce de Leon to the Blue Lantern, and we went into the back where it was all dark, and it was sort of like a lover's lane back there. And the only person around who was walking around was Willie, and he was sort of a strolling troubadour, and he was working for tips in the back parking lot of the Blue Lantern. Well, we heard him play. He would move from car to car. He'd play a song or two, and he'd move on. And he came by the car, and, you know, I introduced myself to him. And he played a couple of songs, and he went on. And I was impressed by his style of playing, so I came back when I could over the next several weeks until one night I asked him if he would make a tape for me, and he said no, he wasn't interested in doing any recording. He'd done recording and it always come to grief. And he told me about experiences he had had in the 20s and 30s, and he was disillusioned by the failure of the record companies that he had recorded for to provide for him in his old age, and he was just very embittered about that. And one night we came back, we were listening to him, and he was pretty drunk that night, and I hung around, and he collapsed and fell over. So I put him in the back of the car. I had a Ford station wagon at the time, and some of the people inside told us where they thought he lived. You know, at that time, the sections of the city were divided up into different sections that we knew about, but the blacks had their own names. They called it like Fourth Ward and Mechanicsville, and the guy would tell you he lived in Mechanicsville. You didn't know where Mechanicsville was. But he lived, if memory serves me, under a place called, of all things, a Dixie Dance Hall. And I think it was late on a Saturday night. We took him back there. And after some commotion in the street over us unloading a body out of the back of a station wagon in the middle of the night, the woman that he stayed with underneath this Dixie Dance Hall in a cellar along the side, it was built on sort of a hill, she came out and testified, you know, to them that he was okay, and we carried him down and we left him there. Well, he woke up, and I put some money in his pocket, you know. He woke up the next morning, and he found that he had not only the money that he, his tips, but extra money. And this startled him, because he had never passed out before in his life that he hadn't been robbed. Now, here he woke up at home. He still had his guitar. He still had his money, and he had more money than he started out with and more than the tips that he'd made. And he had to find, then he went on a quest to find me. So I got a call one day from my mother, who was at that time running my 13th Street store on the corner of 13th and Peachtree, that this gentleman was up there to see me. And you got to understand, this was before desegregation. And that this black man was up there waiting for me with a guitar over his shoulder. And he had walked all the way up there from where he lived, maybe 6 or 7, 8 miles. For a blind person to walk that far to thank me for taking him home. Well, we became more friendly after that, and in the evening sometimes, when he wasn't at the Blue Lantern, sometimes during the week he would come by and he would play. And then one night we were all sitting around, he said, you know, he says, if you want to, he says, you can turn on the machine and we'll see how it sounds, but you got to play it for me afterwards. But I don't want this ever published while I'm alive, because if I did get any money from it, I would just drink myself to death. And I turned the machine on. It was, you know, it was right behind him. It was in the back of the 13th Street store. And I was there, and a couple of my, you know, close friends were there, and some other people drifted in. And he just played, and he had a bottle, and he drank, and when the tape was over, he listened to it, and we took him home. That was the last that I ever saw him.
Part of the tape was later released under the title Last Session, and indeed it was. In the autumn of 1958, Helen died after a brief illness. Willie was once again on his own. After Helen's funeral, he traveled to Statesboro to see some family and friends. When he left for Atlanta, he forgot his guitar. His health continued to decline, and in the spring of 1959, he suffered a stroke. One of his cousins drove to Atlanta and found him sitting on the back porch steps of the house on Dimmitt Street, looking sick and befuddled. He took him home to Thompson. Willie's health improved under the care of his kin in the country. His speech returned, and he picked up his guitar once again, playing for people who passed along the road by the house. But that August, he suffered a second stroke. He was carried to Milledgeville State Hospital, over 50 miles away. A week later, on August 19th, a neighbor who had a telephone drove to the McTeers with the news that Willie McTell had passed away. He was buried in Jones Grove Cemetery outside Thompson. The stone carver mistakenly carved the name of the father he'd barely known on his grave marker. He had asked Kate to make sure that when he went, one of his guitars was buried with him. But she had been notified neither of the death nor the funeral. All Willie's possessions were stored next door to the McTeers. But the house burned down soon after, and everything he had owned was gone. He had died alone. And the few remaining fragments that made up his life had been turned to ashes. But the music, the music, the music went on.
Welcome back, and that was a documentary on the man popularly known as Blind Willie McTell. And, of course, this is the Pan-African Journal, the special worldwide radio broadcast. And we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and this is Black Music Month. And all during the course of this month, we've been featuring various artists who have made a contribution to the evolution of music. And right now we'll take a break with Mr. McKinley Morganfield, probably known as Muddy Waters. Welcome back.
Welcome back.
And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. And, of course, that was the voice of Muddy Waters doing the Willie Dixon composition entitled Smokestack Lightning. And right now we're going to move into a focus on Rosetta Tharpe, the legendary African-American guitarist and singer and performer, one of the leading lights of the 20th century. We're going to listen to the contributions and life and times of Rosetta Tharpe.
She could play a guitar like nobody else. Nobody.
I think Rosetta was a hugely important figure. You know, she was really unique as a guitar player. She had a big influence on somebody like Chuck Berry, who was one of the most influential guitar players in the world.
She did incredible picking.
that's what really attracted Elvis, was her picking. And he liked her singing too, but he liked that picking first because it was so different.
Don't you know, dog, this train is a clean train. Everybody ride it in Jesus' name, because this train is a clean train.
She had a major impact on artists like Elvis Presley. When you see Elvis Presley singing early songs in his career, I think if you imagine that he is channeling Rosetta Tharpe, it's not an image that I think we're used to thinking about when we think about rock and roll history. We don't think about the black woman behind the young white man.
All the kids who grew up in the 40s and 50s knew of her as a superstar. And so I think it's very fair to say that there's a bit of her snuck up in all of rock and roll.
This is the Rosetta Tharpe.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe was born close by the mighty Mississippi on March 20, 1915, in Cotton Plant, Arkansas. Her parents, Katie Bell and Willis Atkins, were cotton pickers.
We don't know too much about Rosetta's father. What we do know about the father is that Willis Atkins could sing, and so it's possible that some of her gift of singing came from her father. Her mother was an evangelist for the Church of God in Christ. Her mother was incredibly passionate about the church.
Rosetta's mother, Miss Katie Bell, is what we called her. She was a very traditional person. And basically, she was what we called a stomp-down Christian. I mean, that's one that enjoyed stamping her feet and patting her hands and celebrating what she believes in. And the reason that I think that Rosetta really became such a strong woman was because of her mother. Because her mother, again, was the same type of person. She had no fear. She would take her guitar, she would take her tambourine, she would take her chair, and she would sit outside and play for people and try to convert them and to get them to go to church.
In 1921, Katie Bell left Rosetta's father to become a traveling evangelist for the Church of God in Christ. Taking the six-year-old Rosetta, she left Cotton Plant and joined the exodus of poor black southerners heading north. There was work in the great city of Chicago, and also something even more crucial for the young Rosetta. The migrants brought the blues from the Mississippi Delta and jazz from New Orleans.
Rosetta is often seen as a country singer, but that's a fallacy. Her major development occurred very early. She moved to Chicago when she was six. She and Mother Bell joined Roberts Temple Church of God in Christ. And the Chicago Sanctified Church was bubbling with musicians and new songs. And so she was exposed to something that was new. It was not rural. It was an urban kind of religious singing.
It was at that church where she first really started performing, where she was the main attraction. There's a great story that has her being put when she's 6 years old on the top of the piano, holding a guitar, being put there so that she could be seen by the congregation and playing and singing and charming everyone with her talent and her precociousness.
There's something within me that's just holding the rein.
She told me that when she was a girl, not even 10, she was immediately seen as an all-purpose musician. She'd go to a revival, and she'd play her guitar. And if the people would get happy afterward and shout, she would drop the guitar and run to the piano and accompany them with her piano chords. And then she might get up and cut a couple of dance steps herself. She was a phenomenal showwoman.
On like battlefield, when with that pleading my poor heart did heal, all I can say, praise God, there's something within.
All through her teens, Rosetta was taken by her mother from city to city to perform in churches, tabernacles, and revival meetings, winning the hearts of thousands with her demure looks, angelic voice, and unique guitar style.
Oh, have you that something, that burning desire?
She soon became a nationwide celebrity within the church.
That never does try.
And this Philadelphia church is one of the first she performed in, back in the 1930s. Those who heard the young Rosetta were inspired for life.
When I saw Rosetta, I was about maybe 10 years old. Oh, she had the most beautiful voice, and the way she could speak to you, it made you feel different. You knew something was going on, even if you didn't understand really what it was. And that's the way it was with me because I was a child.
Many of the hymns were expression of suffering and wanting to survive, many of them. And when she came and they saw the expression of her, the freedom that she expressed in her singing and dancing, it woke up the congregation. It focused them on something that was on the inside that they never gave expression to.
Rosetta would start looking up. She didn't look at anybody. She looked up as if she saw God. And as if God was in her and she was communing with him rather than with a human being.
In 1934, when Rosetta was just 19, her mother married her off to a preacher, the Reverend Tommy Tharp. For the next 4 years, she and Tommy worked for the Church of God in Christ. Her job was to draw the crowds while he preached from the pulpit. But in spite of her mother's good intentions, the marriage was not working out.
Look up! Look up! And see your Maker. Before Gabriel.
I met Sister Rosetta in the summer of 1937. She seemed a little bit glad that she was married, but she didn't seem to be very happy. And that's the reason I took to her. Because, you know, I wanted to just make her happy, make her feel as special as she really was. But I didn't have any idea that she and Tommy wouldn't make it.
He was a tyrant, from what my parents used to say and talk about. He seemed to come out of the real, real sub-old school and believed in the kind of almost caveman-like attitude towards women.
I found that he really wanted her because he figured they could use her to make money to help him make a living. And that's the truth. I hate to say that, but that's the way it turned out to be.
She was just a meal ticket. She was a performer, and he used her to bring people to his churches, and he would put her up to sing. And after a few years, she had enough, and she said, you know what, I'm going to leave all of it. And she made that big jump.
Let down by the first of several men in her life, Rosetta left her husband and took her mother to New York to forge a new life for herself.
My husband and I, we separated a little later too. So she said, well, sister, why don't you come to New York and stay with me and Mama for a little while until you decide what you want to do. So I did. I went there. We would sit up all night long and sing, and she picked the guitar softly, and we both sit up there and cry. We would cry because, you know, we didn't know where we were going from there.
In a city full of nightclubs, Rosetta's talent was soon noticed. She was offered a spot at the prestigious Cotton Club, singing to an upmarket, white audience. But the song she was given by the men in charge made no mention of God, just pleasing her man.
Four, five, fine. Four, five, fine. It's my good night. Drink things like four, five, fine. Now, baby, I'll cry. And baby, I'll cry. What if I'll die? I'm going to talk to me. Four, five, fine. I said four, five, fine.
Four, five,
fine.
Four, five,
fine. Now, he's my king. He makes me sing four, five, fine.
Yes,
I confess.
It was like a bomb had dropped on gospel music when she flipped. It was like, what? You know, I can't believe she, that's Sister Rosetta Tharpe. She's not supposed to be singing that kind of music.
Oh, she was criticized and ostracized. I mean, the church people just, you know, just thought that she had just gone way off.
Four, five, five.
Four, five, five.
Four, five, five.
Oh, four, five, five. Just by desire to set the world on the fire. Four, five, five.
I hear you talking, sister.
Now, maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe you're wrong.
And maybe I'm right.
Maybe I'm right.
If I'm right or wrong, I'm going to swing this song. Four, five, five.
Actually, it was hurtful to a lot of people because they felt as though they had lost something. They had something and it was great, but now it's gone. And they viewed it almost like a death. You know, Rosetta is, she's gone. She went over. She's in like another world.
But having discovered that she loved God and nightclubs, Rosetta decided to sing gospel in church and join the secular world of show business. No longer the good little girl from church, she was happy to defy convention. The offers poured in. She was wanted by all the big bands of the day. She decided to go with the band leader, Lucky Millinder, and manager, Mo Gale. In October 1938, she signed a contract with Decca Records, which was keen to capitalize on the novelty of a gospel singer with a racy new style. This was not the path that her devoted mother, Katie Bell, had chosen, but she stuck by her daughter.
Now, won't you hear me singing the other words that I'm saying?
Her first hit was a song called Rock Me. And the lyric is, Jesus, hear me praying. She sang, won't you hear me praying? So when she came to the chorus, when she sang, rock me, and growled, rock, it sounded really, to many people, like an invitation, and not to the altar.
In the bosom, and the storm,
recording the song that particular way marked her as someone who was having the nerve to reinterpret a spiritual song for a secular audience. I think there was also a piece of her that was just rebellious.
I'm gonna tall, skinny papa. Yeah. I'm gonna tall, skinny papa.
Yeah.
I'm gonna tall.
She does some very risque material with Lucky Millinder, most notably a song called Tall Skinny Papa, which was a big hit for Millinder's band, and she was the lead singer on that. And she sings, I want a tall, skinny papa. There's no way of misinterpreting I want a tall, skinny papa for anything that has to do with spirituality.
The next thing I heard was this recording out of Rosetta with the tall, skinny papa. So I said, it can't be Rosetta. So I went and bought the record when after I listened to it. I said, oh my goodness, sister's out there singing that stuff. So when I saw her, I said, sister, I heard you tell Lucky Millinder that you weren't going to sing that stuff. She said, when I saw that contract, he had a clause in there that I had to sing whatever he gave me to sing. She said, and I didn't know it. And I had a 7-year contract with him. She said, and I had to do it.
It's unclear, I think, how much agency she had in making a recording like Tall Skinny Papa. She was under contractual obligations to Lucky Millinder. She's a young woman without a lot of experience in show business. She may not have been very comfortable with that material. Nevertheless, it's on record, and it was a big hit.
Look down, that lonesome road before you travel down. Look up, oh, look up and see.
Following the controversy of Tall Skinny Papa, Rosetta resolved to stick with the songs she knew best, gospel songs, while giving them her unique, upbeat interpretation.
Reaching down that lonesome road. Look down that lonesome road before you travel on.
She had hit the big time. Her loyal followers back in the church got over the shock and stayed with her, while she gained new fans who just loved her music. It was not an easy trick to pull off, but somehow she did it.
She could go there and come back anytime she wanted to because people loved her. And they loved her no matter what she sang. They loved her.
By the age of 25, Rosetta was rated among the finest popular musicians of the day. Here she is jamming with Duke Ellington at the piano and Cab Calloway on the right.
I can't sit down because I just got to heaven and I can't sit down.
In less than 5 years, she had established herself in a tough male-dominated industry, singing the songs she chose to sing in her own distinctive way.
Who's that yonder dressed in white? I just got to heaven.
She was rich, she was famous, and she was loved by her fans. She was gospel's first superstar.
She used to sing this song called The Fishes and Three Loaves of Bread. And anywhere you went down in the South, it was on the radio. That was a big hit.
Throughout the 40s, she spent much of her time on the road, playing to packed houses, accompanied by different gospel quartets.
The Dixie Hummingbird started with Sister Rosetta in the 40s. They never made records together, but they toured. And Sister Rosetta was always the headliner because it was her show, and she had the choices of picking who she wanted to go out with her. And for many years, she chose the Dixie Hummingbirds. It was a very good mix. People enjoyed the styles because her style was kind of fiery with the guitar. And the Hummingbirds would come out, and then they would jump down in the audience and start singing and really relating to the people. So it was a good mix, and promoters loved it because it always filled houses.
Sometimes we do things we've never done, just playing around with it. Until he goes, that sounds good. Let's try that again. And that's the way we created a lot of stuff, you know.
In a highly segregated society, black and white musicians performing together was taboo. However, Rosetta was happy to defy convention.
She was more or less a pioneer in asking us to even perform with her. She called us her four little white babies. And I thought it was so cute that, you know, that she referred to us as that way. I thought that was just something I'll never forget. And we just loved to sing with her because when she started snapping her finger, man, and started singing on a tune, you couldn't help but sing. I know the first time we worked with her, they booked us. We went to the stage door, and some man came to the door, and one of us said, "Well, we are the Jordanaires." And he said, "You're the Jordanaires? Well," he said, "this is going to be a surprise to our audience. Sister Rosetta didn't tell them that we were white. She booked us, but she didn't tell them we were white." And when we first went out on the stage, they didn't really know how to take us, but then we started singing, working on the building. But then on then we were in.
Listen, everybody, to the precious word. I'm going to do some chirping, and I ain't no bird.
Throughout World War II, America's segregated black soldiers not only adored Rosetta, but could claim her as one of their own.
And now we want you all cats to brush up your fur and be seated while we dish out a dinner that'll dig the undaunty right out from under auntie. And here's the gal who's going to do the chirping for you, Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Sister Tharpe, say hello to Joe way, way out there.
Hello, Joe, way, way out there.
And what are you going to sing, sister?
Down by the riverside.
No films of Rosetta performing traditional gospel songs during the 40s exist today. But this 60s television recording captures the powerful stage presence and unique guitar style that she had developed back in her heyday.
Everything she had learned from her mother, everything she had learned from growing up in the sanctified church, had stayed with her. She was mesmerizing.
My sister and I thought she was the greatest because we had never met a popular singer, only gospel singers. And we saw Rosetta Tharpe playing the guitar and singing. We thought that was the greatest thing we had ever seen in our lives.
The audiences that Sister Rosetta performed in front of were average people. They were people who worked, people who were trying to better themselves, and this music was their inspiration. So when it came to a show that brought in people like Rosetta Tharpe, and there were lines three and four times around the block.
Just to call her name, people would go crazy. And the people just really loved her. All she had to do was walk out on stage, but they knew they were going to get a good performance. And before she left there, the public was part of her, and she was part of the public. And it was like family.
Mm-hmm.
Rosetta had a one-on-one with everybody. I mean, there could be 800,000 people, but she had a one-on-one with you because she could make that music and make that guitar talk just like you were there with her, like you helped to write the song.
I want to meet all of my brothers. Don't you know?
The biggest hit in Rosetta's entire career was Strange Things Happening Every Day, a song that reflected some of the stark contradictions of the times.
All we hear church people say, they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day.
It was recorded at the end of the war, when prosperity and freedom were being proclaimed as the right of all Americans. The song expressed some of the sad ironies she was experiencing on the road. She was a star, but she was also black.
Every day.
Sister Rosetta had a bus. She was the first person that ever had a bus with her name on the side of it that I knew. The back section was beds to sleep in. And that was always something that I thought was really very unusual.
We couldn't stay in some hotel. We had to sleep on the bus. So the bus was really a good idea. Being on the road with Sister Rosetta was very exciting because sometimes we met opposition. And sometimes we met gladness.
Food and hotels, restaurants, all of this, they were all the same. Water fountains, bathrooms, everything was segregated. They had to, as my father used to say, make do.
Jesus is the holy light, turning darkness.
We would go in and eat, and we knew that she didn't have food on the bus, you know, or maybe she had crackers or cheese or, you know, peanut butter or something like that. But we would take what we ordered. We would get her the same thing and take it to her.
Oh, every day.
Sometimes you found someone that took a chance and said, come around to the back door, and they would serve us. But we had to bring it back to the bus still. We couldn't eat it there.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music.
By the age of 30, Rosetta had survived two brief and unhappy marriages and had had numerous affairs with men and women. The only constant person in her life was still her mother, Katie Bell. However, in the spring of 1946, she encountered a young singer called Marie Knight. She was so impressed by her, she suggested they team up. And together they recorded a hugely popular version of the gospel classic, Up Above My Head.
One of the things that made Marie and Rosetta so special as performers is that they were two women who could go on the road without any accompaniment but themselves. Marie was a piano player and percussion player. Rosetta performed on the piano as well as the guitar. And so the two of them together had their entire band with them.
Up above my head.
In 1950, while Rosetta and Marie were performing in California, Marie's mother and two small children were killed in a fire. Traumatized by the loss, Marie drifted away, leaving Rosetta to carry on alone. Less than a year after breaking up with Marie, Rosetta took the most outrageous decision of her life when two concert promoters came up with an audacious publicity stunt. Their plan was to stage Rosetta's third wedding in Washington's huge Griffith Stadium. They would sell tickets to her fans and the recording rights to Decca. Rosetta agreed to go along with the plan. But there was just one problem. She had no one in mind to marry. But just weeks before the big day, she found Russell Morrison, a minor player in the music industry who offered to be both her third husband and her manager.
Tell the truth, I was surprised when she said she was getting married and Russell was going to be the groom.
So she records her wedding ceremony and a concert that follows it in 1951. 25,000 people come out and pay admission prices to attend her wedding. They bring wedding gifts for her. They bring crystal. They bring dishes for her. Someone even buys her a television set. It's a total showbiz move. And at the same time, it's a wedding ceremony conducted by a minister, a real wedding ceremony.
Rosetta was standing on the pitcher's mound, and they had everybody around her and all of the matrons of honor and all these other people who were probably folks that the promoters got together. But they were all there, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful show.
I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome you to Griffith Stadium, where you're about to be guests at the wedding of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, after which there'll be a great spiritual concert followed by fireworks.
And it was nice to see that a lot of her friends had stuck with her and were part of the wedding party. Lucky Millinder is there, Marie Knight is there, and the Rosettes are there.
That stadium was packed.
You know, somebody said it's a fake.
It was packed. I don't see how they could get anybody else in. It was like a circus.
Rosetta, will you have this man to be thy wedded husband? To live after God's ordinance in the holy states of a matrimony?
I mean, it resonated throughout the entire country. It was in newspapers. People talked about it. My parents were so excited about it. For a month in my house before that wedding was just crazy.
Take him by his right hand, Rosetta. Hold it. I, Rosetta.
Take thee, Russell.
From our wedding.
It was like she was Cinderella, you know, and Russell was Prince Charming, and it was a storybook thing.
Kiss the bride, man and wife.
I didn't go to Sister's wedding to Russell. I just figured it was another something that she had gotten herself into. After meeting Russell, I figured that he just wanted an easy living. And I said to myself, oh my goodness, she's doing it again.
Touching on his soul.
So high, can't get on him.
So low,
so low, he can't get on him.
So high,
can't get on him.
Sadly, the misgivings shared by Rosetta's friends proved all too accurate.
While the wedding did boost her record sales briefly, Russell, the manager, was out of his depth.
Russell just, like a cool breeze, just came right in, took over.
He wasn't really a manager. He thought he was a manager. Of course, so many times when they think they are, they aren't. And that's bad.
It was very clear that he was living off her talent, and it was very clear that he was two-timing her. Many people, especially people close to her, like Marie Knight, were furious with him.
In spite of all the criticism, Rosetta remained married to Russell for the next 22 years. Meanwhile, back in the Mississippi Delta of Rosetta's childhood, young white musicians were just beginning to discover the raw energy and complex rhythms of African-American gospel.
There was a hip thing happening in Memphis at that time. There was a little church, and it was cool. It was a cool thing to do on Sunday nights only. You would go there, and there would be Elvis and some of the other guys from the area, and it was unusual because back in those days, white people had to sit in the back, and it was roped off. And we would sit back there, and we would watch these black spiritual singers sing on Sunday night.
Of course, this was the music that Sister Rosetta had brought out of the church and into the wider world nearly 20 years earlier.
The thing that gospel spiritual music brought to popular music was feeling. Gospel spiritual music put the guts and the feeling and the real soul into it. And people like Elvis and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins and those guys, Buddy Holly, if you will, they saw that and they adapted to that, and that really was the essence of rock and roll. Thinking about it, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, she had this great feeling, and that's what Elvis was looking for, feeling, because that's where it all came from.
She gave a lot of people ideas of how to perform. She, the way she performed a song, the way she picked the song, the way she presented it, was an inspiration to anybody who stood around and watched her, and they all watched her.
By the early 60s, her influence was continuing to spread as yet another generation fell under her spell. Here is a recording of Bob Dylan speaking about Rosetta on the radio.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe was anything but ordinary and plain. She was a big, good-looking woman and divine, not to mention sublime and splendid. She was a powerful force of nature. A guitar-playing, singing evangelist.
It's a clean train. Everybody ride it, if you can.
You know, she traveled to England with Muddy Waters and a whole bunch of other blues performers in the early 60s. And I'm sure there are a lot of young English guys who picked up an electric guitar after getting a look at her.
It's standing in the station. This train is waiting on all of you. Come on and let's go. This train...
In the summer of 1964, Rosetta was booked by Granada Television to perform in a folk, blues, and gospel special. The musicians were American, the audience English students, the venue a disused railway station, Chorlton-cum-Hardy, just outside Manchester.
The Manchester gig was a curiosity in the middle of the tour for us. It was kind of bizarre, but, you know, we were all new to England, and we were aware of all this interest in blues and gospel. We all thought it was strange, the setup with the audience on one platform and the musicians on the other. And she rose to the occasion. She loved the drama of the situation and trying to bridge that gap between the platforms and sell the whole thing across the track to the audience.
By now, Rosetta was 49 years old, and she had been on the road for more than 40 of those years. But even in cold, wet, and windy England, the magic was still there.
I take great pleasure and bring it to you one of the greatest, one of the world's greatest gospel singers, and guitar virtuoso, the inimitable Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
All the sweethearts. Oh, this is the wonderful time of my life. And the people are so sweet to stay here. And I come in on them.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what I come in on. Oh, yeah!
Rosetta was a huge success in the tour. I mean, she did great. Audiences loved her. She was very happy. Everybody was happy.
Oh, I love you so, my English friends, forever and ever until I leave this world.
While Rosetta was away in Europe, her mother was becoming increasingly frail. In 1968, Katie Bell died. For 53 years, she had stuck close by her daughter, through good times and bad, as the one constant figure, reminding Rosetta of her faith in God. The loss took a heavy toll on Rosetta. She became increasingly depressed, and to make matters worse, she was diagnosed with diabetes.
I'm going to sing a song that maybe you wouldn't understand it, and maybe you do. A song that I love so dearly. And I have so many friends here in Copenhagen. For many, many years I've been coming here. And then sometime my friends...
Made in 1970 in Denmark, this is the last known recording of Sister Rosetta performing.
Maybe you wouldn't understand that, but someone died who they dearly love. And mine did too. My mother died 2 years ago and left me alone. But nevertheless, I have you.
I went to see her, and she had this black spot on her foot. I said, "Sister, what is that?" And she said, "I don't know." I said, "Sister, go see about that, please."
That arm hurt them. That's going to happen. But there is a divine power. I believe it. I don't know about you, but I got to believe it because I was raised that way. I sing this song. Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, and let me stand. I'm tired, you done worked so hard, and I'm weak. My body is worn. Oh, yes. But I got to go anyhow. Through the storm.
She wouldn't listen to anybody. So the next thing, foot started turning black. Then she did have to go to the doctor. Then they found out they had to cut a leg off.
Just the same.
Sometimes she would call me and say, "Sister, please come. Please come to see me." And I would say, "All right, I'm coming." But the last few months I didn't go because, you know, Russell was acting like he didn't want nobody taking over from him.
When I went over to see Aunt Sis, she was in the bed and she would say, "Where's Russell?" I said, "Downstairs." And she would say, "He's asking you about shows, right?" And I said, "No, he didn't say anything." He said, "Yes, he is. He wants to know if I'm going back." She said, "And I'm going back. But I'm not going to tell anybody when I'm coming back. But I am coming back." But she never did.
My body is all suffering in pain. Got no one to call on. Hear my cry. Hear my call. Please hold my hand, lest I fall. Take my hand. Oh, precious Lord.
Rosetta's funeral was very quiet. It wasn't any big thing. It was no elaborate funeral, I can tell you that.
The church was half full, and Rosetta looked the best I had seen her in years. Marie Knight, her old partner, she made Rosetta up. She took care of her coiffure, of her makeup, of how the fabrics looked, and made her as glamorous as possible. She looked a star.
I think I said, she would sing until you cried. And then she would sing until you danced for joy. She kept the church alive and the saints rejoicing.
Down at the river. Trembling hand, and take my hand. Oh, precious Lord, lead me.
In 2008, some 35 years after Rosetta's death, the governor of Pennsylvania declared that henceforth, the 11th of January will be known as Sister Rosetta Tharpe Day.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Now up above my head.
Up above my head.
You know
head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
And I read a jubilee.
And I read a jubilee.
There's a heaven somewhere. Heaven somewhere.
Welcome back, and that was a documentary on the lifetimes and contributions of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, and this is Black Music Month, and we're going to continue for the next two programs to focus on black music from all over the world. We're going to close out our program with Book a Little from the album Out Front from 1961. Have a beautiful week.